Good morning. I'm Anil Dash. Thanks, you all, for coming out. We're going to have a conversation today with Nick Denton about Gawker, about comments, about the web. And this is a very appropriate venue for it. Nick and I actually met at South by Southwest for the first time. We were doing the math. It was probably 10 years ago, maybe more. And actually, the context is useful for the conversation we'll have. We jumped in a cab with a lot of the team that had made Blogger. Ev Williams, Meg Horahan, a lot of the folks that had made some of the original tools for blogging. I had known of Nick from a company he had done called Moreover, but didn't know him, and hopped in this cab. And our mutual friends had mentioned that I lived in New York, and Nick was talking about, at that time, considering moving to New York to start a media company that would become Gawker. And it was really interesting. He was talking about how blogs could be aggregated. There was the idea of how news would evolve. And my thinking was, I don't think I've ever sat next to a millionaire in a taxi before. That was really exciting. I wonder how much this guy is worth. And then the other thought I had was...
I think it was much less than you think back then.
But that was, you know, I was like, this is true. And then the other part I was really excited about was, is this guy gay or just European? And I didn't know. So I've always been in the target audience for Gawker and many of the Gawker sites. And I thought that was a really nice evolution that we got to see those kinds of questions answered.
Being yourself often mistaken for gay and European.
Absolutely. So it was a very, it was an auspicious beginning. And then less than a year later, in a bar in the East Village, you showed me the first versions of Gizmodo and Gawker. Gizmodo, I think, would launch first. And what was striking was here was it looked like a blog, but it had ads on it. I'd never seen a blog with advertising on it. And that was mind-blowing.
And I'm sorry about that. It was,
yeah, thanks for that. You really
the
helped
the
media.
Kind of took a wrong turn back then.
But here's the striking thing, is that idea alone was considered radical, that blogs were media, that we should take them that seriously. And here we are 10 years later, and we've got all the sites up, but you look at Gizmodo, Gawker, Kotaku, Lifehacker, I can do these from memory now that they're shut off, Defamer, back in the day, Deadspin, Jezebel. There's an amazing portfolio of sites here. How many of you have never read a Gawker site? All right, two hands. And how many of you have regularly seen one, like once every few, a couple times a week or at least every day? Right, almost everybody. And that's an amazing thing to have happened in about a decade. And I'll start actually with, there was a segment on Rock Center on NBC News last week. And they talked about Gawker as if they assumed their audience was kind of from space. Right? So they said, there's a thing called the internet. On the internet, there are websites. One of them is Gawker. It's a place where you read about news. But the descriptions from afar sound nothing like the sites that we recognize. So we're just starting point. What is Gawker? What is Gawker Media? What are these sites?
This is a story so old, I've gotten bored telling it. I'm sure people have gotten bored hearing it.
But we'll punch it up.
I used to be a journalist. I used to be a journalist with the Financial Times and with The Economist. And I was struck by how the conversations that you'd actually have with other journalists after deadline were way more interesting, sometimes gossipy and sometimes shallow, but way more interesting than what would appear in the newspaper the next morning. And that was the initial impulse behind, I think, a lot of blogs at the time. It was the story behind the story, and we turned it into a business, and that's still very much the central principle. It's the, what do we think, what do we know, don't consider too much before you put it down on the page. And the danger that we face, and we'll probably get into this when we talk about comments, the danger we face is that we have become a media company and we've developed some of the habits of a media company.
Yeah. And to be clear, for today's conversation, we're going to start talking about Gawker. I'm going to do some Q&A because I know people have a lot of questions about Gawker as a company and about the different sites. And then we're going to dive deeply into the topic of comments, which is really the focus for today. And I assume, obviously, if you're going to talk about comments, you want to have questions about that as well. One starting point, though, is so much of the brand is, gossip and the story behind the story. But I look at the portfolio of sites, and if I look at Lifehacker, I look at IO9, I look at Kotaku, even Jalopnik to some degree, these are nerd sites, right? These are car nerds, sci-fi nerds, whatever the hell, Lifehacker nerds, email nerds.
You say nerds don't like gossip either?
Well, is there gossip? if I'm writing, like, here's my new to-do list and here's the engine in this new car.
Look, gossip is just news. Gossip is just the news that you really want, as opposed to the news that wins Pulitzer Prizes, or the news that you're told you should read, or that boring report about something at some political shenanigans in Albany.
Okay. So by that reckoning, the sort of Gizmodo iPhone 4 leak is the perfect gossip story.
It was a great story. Mm-hmm. And we don't want to be judged by this American standards or J school standards of what news is. So if we were to come out and say, okay, we are a news property, we have a collection of news properties, then I think we'd be judged by standards that we're not very interested in. The only standard that we care about is to entertain and inform our readers and to tell the truth. To tell the truth, even if it's messy and dirty and scummy and
But isn't
gossipy.
That the exact same thing every other media site says? Right? Don't they all say we care about the truth, we're going to tell the truth? I mean, is that really distinct?
Well, and we don't say it. I probably shouldn't have said it now. It's a dangerous thing to claim to be on a mission to seek out the truth. Mm. I think ours is a particular version of the truth. It's like, can you handle the truth? Are you ready for the truth? it's a bit of a challenge as much as anything.
It's a few
else.
Good men kind of thing. You can't handle the truth.
Do people really want all the truth? Sometimes they do. I think most of the time, as readers, they do. You know, as colleagues of somebody, they don't. The great power story, the iPhone story. Right. You know, that was actually a great example, because you know, there you had an entire community of many geeks who felt some sympathy for. Great power was the engineer who lost the iPhone in the bar.
The guy that left it in the bar, right?
And we not only exposed the iPhone, but we exposed him, and we exposed the whole story of the poor dude who left the iPhone in the bar. And readers love that story. It's a fantastic story. You get to see the iPhone 2 months early. Steve Jobs gets really pissed. And it's a fantastic human story. The poor dude in the bar.
But they thought you were jerks for outing the guy, right?
I think anyone who was a geek felt, okay, this is a fellow geek. And in fact, anyone who's a human being felt, this is a fellow human being.
Are you asserting that your audience is human beings?
But everybody people love stories like that. They love them and they hate them. Right. They feel sympathy for the subject, but they want to read the story.
So some of the goal is you got to feel a little bit dirty about how much you like the story.
I think the real goal is that we knew who he was, and should we have kept that quiet? Should that have been in the old world? A story like that would have been passed around by journalists to other journalists. It would have stayed within the elite. It would have gone round and round. Everyone would have used it as currency. And still now in politics and in celebrity coverage, the same thing applies. The people keep the best stories for themselves. They don't want to publish it out there. Mm-hmm. And the truth of the matter is the blogs were supposed to revolutionize that. Blogs and actually social media were supposed to democratize. They're supposed to level the playing field, supposed to take all the stories and make the reader as informed as the writer.
Right. So when the White House press corps used to know...
And it didn't happen.
When the White House press corps used to know that John Kennedy was philandering, they kept that story for themselves, and in the modern Gawker world, that wouldn't happen.
It still happens. It still happens way too much.
Okay. So related to that, one of the, I think, more interesting recent breakout examples of that was Brian Williams' comments on Lana Del Rey on SNL. So you got to have this conversation. The background is Lana Del Rey is on SNL. She was fairly poorly received. And you are friends with Brian Williams. You're an acquaintance.
Was friends, yeah.
Right. You solved that problem. Talk me through how it happened from your perspective. What was the email you got?
So we weren't friends. We were acquaintances. We'd had dinner a couple of times. As you can tell from his persona on television, he's a charming dude. And he started emailing. He'd email tips. Most of the stories that appear on Gawker sites come as tips from people. And they come as tips, actually often from other journalists. It's the stories that they can't run themselves, that they're too dainty to run, that they want to see out there, because all gossips are journalists. And he sent me this note about the Lana Del Rey outing, saying it was the worst outing ever on SNL. Hmm. I forwarded it because in the email, it's the context was, why it hasn't Gorka written about it yet? So I forwarded it to the editor of Gorka, intending it as a rebuke for our lack of coverage. And he, rebuking me for my celebrity friendships, published the email on the site.
And now you and Brian are no longer acquaintances.
Well, I have a voicemail from him, which I haven't listened to because...
Why haven't you published it?
What?
Why haven't you published it? Listen to it. I want to hear it. Play it now.
You're tempting me. But I won't get any page views out of this, so what's the point?
Now, the video will eventually go up on the site. We'll get it up there. So, but that is an interesting thing, is there is something intrinsic, and this actually leads into the conversation about comments. There are times when the site is oppositional, antagonistic towards everyone from sources that it covers, that it quotes, the people who give tips, to its own staff. You've had people air out their dirty laundry on the site. And then, obviously, sometimes towards the reader and the audience and the commenter. Right, there's all kinds. There's a lot of different points.
There's a lot of conflict.
Yeah, there's a lot of conflict, a lot of antagonism.
I mean, not on every site. You know, Lifehacker and IO9 are the nicest sites you could ever imagine.
Lifehacker, everybody's hugging each other. But generally, the brand is this sort of this confrontation.
I mean, there's a spectrum, and yes, at the Gorka end of the spectrum, there is conflict.
Well, and how you sell ads. Right, the reason it's a business is advertisers are like, this is this kind of sexy confrontational.
Yeah, I think our original tagline was unhealthily obsessed. You know, we were not trying to sell ourselves as purveyors of apple pie.
If there's that much tension, confrontation, intrinsic to the brand, can you ever have a good conversation on the site?
Have you ever had a good conversation with people who just agreed? It sounds like the most boring conversation on the planet.
I mean, sounds like San Francisco. I love San Francisco. Very nice.
A good conversation involves disagreement. It involves disagreement, which is hopefully expressed with wit and intelligence, but it involves disagreement.
Well, so there's the question. Is the wit and intelligence sufficient to bring people up who are in conflict into having a productive conversation? Or are they all...
Are we switching over to the comment part of the...
I think we will momentarily.
...of the evening?
Actually, why don't we do that before we do that? If there's questions about Gawker Media as a whole, about the various sites, before we dive deeply into the comment part of the conversation, I'd love to see if there's anybody...
This is your last chance to ask about the redesign of 2011.
Oh, yeah. Actually, let's briefly talk about that so people can line up here at this microphone if you have
time. I can't believe I just did that.
Yeah, well, it's old news, and I didn't think you covered old news on the site, but we'll go to it. About a year ago, actually longer than that ago, you started talking about this redesign, and it was challenging the tyranny of the fact that blogs are always the newest thing on top. And you'd use the iPhone story example as a hook for this. That was the most important story, and you had to stop putting other stories up on the site.
Yeah, we had to stop publishing for a whole day in order to keep that at the top of the site.
Right. So your solution to this was... change the layout of the page so you can pin a story in the main area and then still have that column on the side. How is that working for you?
We went down by about 25%. Mm-hmm. Actually, for a bunch of technical reasons. We've messed up our Google indexing.
Okay.
But we got it all back, and we're probably about 20% above where we were.
Well, some of this, though, is you didn't actually have to change anything. You could have kept on with the same design and sometimes stopped publishing in order to promote good stories. Why did you want to make that radical change to the site?
I wanted us to devote our attention to editorially and in terms of design to our best stories and not our worst. And I think you've seen in the last 12 months, putting aside all the numbers, which show a rebound. You know, we're probably below where we would have been. But we're way back on where we were. The biggest change, the biggest improvement, I think, has been the quality of the stories. Mm-hmm. That one of the reasons why that Brian Williams piece went up was because it was Monday morning, and AJ, who's the editor of Gorka, he was a new editor of Gorka, he didn't have anything else for what we call the splash for the front page. He didn't have a shocking story. And
so you want to fill that big spot with something compelling.
Well, when you're running a blog, you just throw out some volume. You don't have to think about having a story that's so compelling that it's going to try to you're going to try to win the internet every single minute of the day. If you have a splash, if you have one dominant story, then that's a big. It's very stressful for editors, but stressful, I think, in a good way, that it puts pressure on them to come up with stuff that's worthy of the slot.
So that's interesting. And one of the other questions that comes from the redesign is, you actually went very technically ambitious. It's got all this kind of HTML5, kind of different types of scrolling. It's much more, much more complex than any other standard blog had been before that. How much of this is, you know, do you want Gawker to be a technical company? Do you want to be inventing technology there? You've made a lot of tech.
I would like us very much to fix or help to fix the problem of discussion and comments on the web, because it's a big, big problem.
So just discussion and comments?
That's our main focus, yeah.
Okay. Well, and one of the reasons I ask is early on, your prior company before Gawker had been Moreover, and you had... early in the days of Gawker, wanted to build a news aggregator. That was a big part of this. I won't ask about Sploid because you and I are probably the only people that remember the site. But I think
you're going to date yourself if you don't care.
Yeah. Well, I don't mean to dwell in 10 years ago, but
I've moved on. Have you?
Well, no. I think it's an interesting time because there was a very fertile moment at the genesis of when Gawker was born. People trying to build new tools, build new technologies. Most people, when they do a new startup, are trying to atone for what they screwed up in their last startup, right? So your last startup did a lot of interesting things around RSS and aggregation and that stuff. Do you still have an itch you want to scratch around solving technology for how blogs and RSS are going
to
work?
I think it's certainly true. People try to solve the same problem again and again and again, mm-hmm. and if they're lucky, they get closer to the solution as their career goes on.
Right.
And
but you're not doing that.
What?
But you're not doing that.
No, I think I am, actually.
Okay.
If you think about Kinja, which is the
long
lost project that you're talking about,
one of the first projects
and Matt Hamer is here, it was
a very interesting experiment around aggregating blogs into a news experience.
So this actually goes back to Blogger. It goes back to Blogger and the cooperation between Blogger and Moreover. Mm-hmm. That thing. Remember the news Blogger?
Yes. Yeah. So by way of explanation, ancient history for people, Blogger, before it was bought by Google, did a partnership with Nick's then company, Moreover, made a tool called NewsBlogger that was essentially what today we'd call reblogging. You could read a bunch of blogs, read a bunch of news stories, and post them all into your own aggregation. These days, you could do that on Tumblr with a couple clicks, but it was very ahead of its time and very interesting. And how close does that mimic your process today, what your editors do?
Well, I want good conversations online, and that's... Yeah, I guess in the late 90s, in fact, probably when we met, there was still a hope that online one could capture one could capture the intelligence of the readership, that the web would allow writers and readers to collaborate on stories. Mm-hmm. I like this idea of something called iterative reporting, that would be reporting where you could, instead of saving up, doing all the research and saving up the story and then publishing it in one big dump, you would put out your notes. Your notes would be exposed in public, and the sources would help you construct.
So you would have
the story.
This living story with all the notes and everything piled into it.
That didn't happen. It didn't happen. It's a promise that there was. It's a promise that has so not happened that people don't even have that ambition anymore.
Right. They forgot that was even a possibility.
The idea of capturing the intelligence of the readership, that sounds like a joke.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How many of you like YouTube comments? Kind of show of hands. Actually, I mean, and we were talking about this earlier. Curious about what are the traits, what are the adjectives you would all ascribe to comments on the web? Like, how many of you think web comments you think intelligent, vitriolic, insipid, lowest common denominator, right? Like, so it's really interesting, the sort of the responses. I think we got a question here.
Hey Nick. Hey. My name's Jeremy Zeiler. I oversee all the blogs at the New York Times. So traffic's gone up by 20%, but how much of that's attributed to the design versus the general increase in consistency in posting, and you're just even the kind of redesign as a process for introspection within?
I don't really know. to tell you the truth. It could be a bunch of things. It could be a rebound after a self-inflicted wound. It could be just the fact we have some of the best writers and editors around. Our tech performance is actually excellent at the moment, so sites are very responsive. There's a whole bunch of factors. It's very hard to disentangle them.
In general, like, your posting is much more rhythmic, much more consistent in length since the redesign. It seems like a length, image quality, presentation, the content, as opposed to the design. I was just trying to separate those two.
The image quality has improved a lot. I don't think people care that much about image quality. Readers do. I think advertisers care about the visual look more than readers do. There are plenty of successful sites that are butt ugly.
Right.
So that's a really interesting question, too, there, is how much do you think design influences content and vice versa? I mean, if the sites were simpler and less pretty, would they be as compelling just because of the content?
You know, I'm going to pass on that. I haven't really thought about it enough.
Over your pay grade? Another question.
Hey, my name's Brian Keller. I'm Director of User Experience at Euro RSCG in New York. And I was really heavy into the Gawker comment community a few years ago, where we had the commenters' balls and we would mill meet and we kind of knew each other. And occasionally some of the writers would come and it would be kind of like a star moment and everything. And I actually won comment of the year 1 year. But anyway, my question is, I don't know why. It wasn't a very good comment. But
please. Oh, by the way, I was commenter of the year.
I was, yes.
What was your screen name?
Nick Fitt. Right, so, and then I think so I either got banned or the technology locked me out. And then, of course, the all.com happened and then all those kids went over there. And you know the story, right?
You know, I love the all commenters have now moved on to the hairpin.
Have they?
Yeah.
And then they'll move on to something else. But it's actually a lot of the same people from that time. But we did have a feeling that we were part of a kind of an enlightened conversation. Like, we all kind of knew who each other were. We went to these drinking events. And it seems like when everybody moved over to the All, there was this kind of idea like, oh, well, you know, Gawker is now, you know, we're cooler now or something like that. I mean, it's all kind of bullshit, yeah. Right? But so I don't know. I think it's sad in a way that you think that it never happened, because it did around your site. I believe maybe a small subsection of the commenters.
It was awesome, and yeah, and frankly, the comments on I'm dissatisfied by the comments on our sites, but they're still way better than on most sites of competing scale. But the fact is that Gawker is now probably five times the audience that it did back in the day when, you know, in the halcyon age of Corey Seeker.
Right.
And one of the things that's evident online is that there's a scale problem. That you can manage on a small site like a Boing Boing Gadgets or, you know, maybe some of the deeper recesses of Chowhound, the kind of level of discussion that you can actually have on those is not the level of discussion that is possible to have on a big newspaper site or on one of our larger sites. And our smaller site now has, you know, 2 million uniques. That's small for us.
Yeah.
And it's very hard to maintain the same intimacy that you had in the early days. And that's the challenge that we're addressing now.
So that's a really interesting example. We were talking earlier about Boing Boing Gadgets was that example you went to. It's a kind of obscure example, but Joel Johnson had been an editor of it, and early on had done a conversation asking about the early days of Wired. Talk a little bit about why that post and that thread were interesting to you.
I'm obsessed by this particular post. I can't remember what the headline is, but it was a post that was 400 words or so, and it triggered, I guess, because Joel had been involved with Wired himself, and so he had some natural authority, but it drew in every single person who had been involved in the history of Wired, it seemed, from Chris Anderson on down.
Current editors, former editors, publishers, everybody.
It was a complete oral history. It was one of those examples where the comments were just so much better than the original post was fine, but it was a historical document that had been assembled at the cost of a 400-word post, which sounds like about the best editorial model you can possibly imagine.
Right. How many of you saw the branch conversation that had gone on prior to this panel? I know a few of you had tweeted the link and posted.
Yeah, Branch is fascinating.
So Branch is a startup that does roundtables of invited participants, and I'd asked former Gawker editors, peers, and competitors of Nick's in the New York media community to weigh in. And though the conversation was very pointed, there were actually some very interesting points that came out of it in a closed commenting community by having a half dozen people who were allowed to comment. Now, you've said one of the problems is scale with having a good conversation. Is Gawker going to start to do invited commenters that are, you know, these are the five people that can comment on this post?
Yes.
How are you going to do it?
I think it's part of the answer. We should probably back up a little bit.
Sure.
I think what we have is in comments is what economists would call the tragedy of the commons, or in fact, what you should call it, the tragedy of the comments. The idea that without fences, without any delineated rights and responsibilities, that a discussion area gets overtaken, and the larger the site, the more it would get overtaken, overused. No one really feels ownership. Particularly as you get lots of participants, and the quality of the environment deteriorates to the point at which it becomes a complete wasteland. And that's been the story of online discussion environments since before blogs.
So you need to have constraints in order to have good comments.
I think you need to have responsibility. You need to have responsibility being allocated. And Branch is a good example of responsibility being allocated. You are responsible.
Right.
Yeah. You were responsible for choosing the participants. It was public, but the membership was limited. Mm-hmm. And you invited people. They were participating under their own names. Mm-hmm. So I think that is a significant part of the answer of creating, building fences around particular discussion areas. And the core of the Gawker idea, the system that we're building and that we're launching, will be launched on Gawker.com in about 6 weeks' time, is the idea that everybody owns the thread that they start. Everybody owns the discussion that they trigger.
So even if you're not a Gawker editor, not a Gawker employee, you can own a comment thread within a post and say, I'm going to curate how this conversation goes.
Exactly. Because think about what I want. What I want is I want the sources. I want the experts, the authorities, to be able to come into the discussions. I don't want it to be, even if the Gawker commenting clique of 2006 was a pretty high-class commenting clique, it was still a commenting clique. It was still off-putting to outsiders. It was hard to induce sources to come in and to make their points, to rebut. I'd say to people, don't call me, don't IM me, don't email me. Go in the comments and say your piece.
So people right now, sources, people who are newsmakers, call you.
Yeah, or Brian Williams would send me an email.
Right.
You know, or Dov Charney from American Apparel, in response to all the coverage of the sexual harassment cases against him on Jezebel, would call up and frankly, waste a lot of editorial time calling up and complaining about the coverage.
But Dov Charney's never going to go into your comments, is he?
Well, right now, it was no way he'd go in the comments, because if Dov Charney went into the Jezebel comments, he would be literally torn limb from limb. And it wouldn't just be his limbs that would be torn.
That's right. No, but take Brian Williams as an example.
But what if we could actually, maybe Dov Charney's right. The extreme case.
Right.
If we can provide security for Dov Charney to say his piece, then we would have cracked the problem entirely. But a lot of people, I don't like going into the comments, because for every two comments that are actually interesting, even if they're critical, they're interesting and you want to engage with them, there'll be eight that will be off-topic or just toxic, and I want to be able to deal with, as a commenter, I want to be able to deal with the intelligent critics and not with everybody.
So, and we'll get to the questions in just a moment. When I had, about 6 months ago, I wrote a blog post that if your website's full of assholes, it's your fault. And this is actually one of the things that kind of kicked off you and I reengaging around this topic, which is there's a personal responsibility piece, which is if people are being that snarky, that cutting, that negative to each other, isn't it because of the tone of the site or because you haven't moderated that behavior in the past?
I mean, it's certainly true that nice sites run by nice people, particularly if they're nice and firm, as Adam Pasch at Lifehacker and Annalie Newitz at IO9R, that encourages good behavior. But it's a feedback mechanism. It's not as if it's simply the writer's setting the tone for the comments. The comments also set the tone for the writer. Mm-hmm. That there are stories that I know that we would run on our sites, earnest stories, that our writers are afraid to write because those are the ones that are most vulnerable to jeers from the commenters.
And how much of this is advertising driven? Is you want nicer comments because it's a business consideration?
Nothing.
None?
No.
Okay.
I mean, we want to have nicer comments because we want to have better sites, and the effect of that commercially is that if you have better sites, then they grow and you get more advertising.
So only indirectly. But yeah. And then similarly, how much of the desire of the commenters to be negative is speaking truth to power, right? Your editors are frequently Ivy League educated. They you know, live in New York City. They've got health care, right? They're much better off than most of your commenters are. So shouldn't your commenters be attacking them?
Well, some of our commenters have actually become editors. You know, Ryan Tate was a commenter. Mm-hmm. Richard Lawson was a commenter. If we can soften the sometimes antagonistic relationship between writers and commenters that exists both within some of our sites, but also more generally on the web. You know, no newspaper journalist likes their commenters.
Right.
You should hear the things they say. If we can actually soften that divide, then maybe we make it easier for us to hire people like Ryan Tate, and it becomes more of a talent.
But should you soften it? I mean, if for the same reasons that you need to attack the institutions you attack, shouldn't you be...
I think we do want to soften it because we want to give more responsibility to people. So we want to push responsibility down. Right now, who has responsibility for the quality of the discussions? You know, sometimes the site lead, but can they read all the comments on all the posts?
Yeah.
The writer of the piece has to move on to the next piece. They don't have time to moderate all those comments. A moderator is probably not going to be specifically an expert in that topic, and they're not going to have contacts with the sources, therefore they're not going to be able to bring those people in. Right now, there's nobody to take responsibility. Mm-hmm. What we want to do is give everybody responsibility over the threads that they start.
And that's not just purely to farm it out so that you don't have to pay for more moderators?
No, it's in order to... It's in order to share responsibility, to share ownership, and so if somebody gets our system is going to involve people being able to coming an inbox of replies to their comments, and they will be able to accept or dismiss, to engage or not to engage with the comments they want to deal with. To dismiss a comment would not be to delete it, but it will be to split the conversation. So it's basically saying, you know what, have that conversation, but have it in another room. This is my room. You know, just as in Branch, that was your room, mm-hmm. that was your conversation. So we want to create that sense of ownership and separation so people can have civilized and critical, and sometimes they can disagree with each other, but at least they should do it interestingly.
Okay. Let's go to a question.
Okay, my question is roughly in that area. You had talked about getting to reader intelligence, and you had talked about the tragedy of the commons. So you talked about who can...
Do you like that phrase, by the way,
I
the
do.
Tragedy of the commons?
I enjoy it.
He's very proud of it.
I'm trying to acknowledge the tragedy of the comments.
I like it. So what opportunities or constraints are there in peer escalation? So you're choosing to give the owner of the original thread or post the moderator role. Why isn't there a way to crowdsource the discussion? So like a peer escalation of comments, so the readership is judging what content goes on there. What would be constraints around that versus the choice you're going, where the original writer of the thread will own more of the editorial process?
You're thinking more of like a Reddit kind of upvoting, downvoting
something
system?
Something around that.
This is where we diverge, I think, from the internet mainstream, which is that we don't really believe in some democratic process of decision making when it comes to discussion. Dov Charney, I want to hear from Dov Charney if he'll go in. And if you put it to a vote, 90% of people on Jezebel would vote to ban him. They hate that guy. You know, 80% of them would probably lynch him. You can't afford to, if you want to have interesting dissenting opinions, you can't afford to put it to the vote.
Okay. Do you lose the minority opinion?
Yeah.
Other question?
So on the basis of personal responsibility, I just wanted to get your opinion on how you feel about, because we just enacted this on our site, and how you feel about Facebook commenting.
What's your site?
Facebook commenting and how you feel about that. And I know, obviously, you're against the democratic nature of comments, and that would... uphold that, but it also includes the personal responsibility part.
I think Facebook comments are very interesting, and obviously a lot of sites have you know, given in despair at their own commenting systems, they have put themselves in Facebook's hands. I think TechCrunch's move to do that has made for more polite comments, but much less interesting comments. And my own view is that anonymity is at the heart of the internet and discovery of truth through the internet. And since the early days of the internet, when you had misfit teens finding each other in the Midwest, because they were anonymous, they could actually be themselves. Anonymity has been critical for self-discovery. It's been critical for people within organizations to expose the truth about those organizations. And for an organization like ours that is trying in our own fucked up way to get to the truth, we have to have anonymity as one of our tools, and therefore anonymity has to be baked into our commenting system. And the Facebook answer may be an answer for some people, but it can't be an answer for us.
So there's also an interesting balance of anonymity leaves you with a problem, right? If you do a thread on Lana Del Rey and somebody says worst performance ever, and it doesn't say Brian Williams, then who cares, right? That comment's not worthwhile without identity around it.
Have you never seen a comment that was anonymous, but where the authority just reeks of authority? You thought, okay, this person absolutely knows.
Sure, I used to work at that company, and here's what I know about it. Those kinds of
things. And if there are a couple of facts mentioned in a post that correlate with your own view, you'll ascribe a certain amount of credibility to that comment. And those are actually the most interesting comments. This is why most systems that have been developed, including our own, were so broken. Because the most interesting comments, they don't come from people with clout scores. They don't come from people who've actually have a long history of commenting on our sites or any sites. Often it's a first timer. Often it's anonymous. Sometimes they're so outraged by what you just wrote that they want to set the record straight. Those are the most valuable comments of all, and no system that is currently in existence actually allows those comments to rise to the top.
Or accommodates them well. So our mutual acquaintance, Jonah Peretti, first when he was at HuffPo and now at BuzzFeed, has been very strongly advocating around the social connection of comments, that hooking in Twitter, hooking in Facebook is this sort of essential part of what you do. So separate from identity, how important are Facebook and Twitter generally for driving traffic on the sites, having that social component as part of commenting, and how important are they just actually relative to one another? Which networks do you care about?
I mean, a little sidetrack here, but I think Jonah's approach is interesting. It was very interesting on Huffington Post, and it's another school of thought because they are entirely volume focused. Mm-hmm. The purpose of the comments is not to develop a story. It's not to expose the truth. The purpose of comments is simply to allow readers to feel like participants. Even if they're not really participants, it's allow them to express themselves. And we don't care about the volume of comments. I could quite happily publish half as many comments if they were twice as interesting. And that would be a trade-off that we would make.
Not driving pure engagement in that level. Ted, you got a question?
Oh. Yeah, hi, Ted Reingold. Nick, I'm really excited about this. I think your strategy is going to be really successful, and adding responsibilities to commenters is, I think Verge is doing it a little bit. But I would love to hear about what strategies you've tried before to bring responsibility to commenters, like in the verbiage about, like, I notice you use contribute versus, and have there things that have failed or not worked as well, or just here?
I think we and everybody else made a huge wrong turning in the gamification of comments. That what we did initially was we had an approval process, so you had to go through some vetting before you'd be approved, and then you could comment. And then we introduced another layer to the hierarchy. A VIP star system, so we gave people stars. And those stars had some extra powers. They could approve comments from new commenters. Their contributions were more heavily weighted. The public process of starring and banning has been way too drama ridden, and the realization
it stresses the editors out and things.
It stresses everybody out, yeah. And the realization I've come to is that if you're trying to encourage really good contributions, the people who want to make really good contributions, the people who are motivated to contradict you in an article, they do not care about badges. The people who care about badges are the people who they need some psychological benefit they're getting to the badges. They are not necessarily the people who are going to contribute the most information. It's kind of insulting. What, we're going to give you a star if you wrote something smart. If you wrote something smart, we should publish it, and we should publish it prominently. Like that's the reward that you need, not a badge like you're in high school.
Well, that actually sounds like you're optimizing for not repeat visitors who are super engaged, but you're optimizing for somebody who might less frequently comment but have that really, really detailed feedback. Is there any site that does that well today?
I don't think so.
Yeah, and your willingness to experiment...
I wouldn't say necessarily optimize for that, but certainly those people... Pretty much everyone in this room, I'm assuming, is savvy that they know how comment environments or discussion environments generally work. It's a really intimidating environment for most people. And if you actually want to get, it's intimidating technically. You know, often it's actually harder to sign up than you'd think, and it's intimidating because it feels like you're entering into a world in which everybody knows each other. They have a certain language. And most people can't be bothered, or they don't want to, or they're turned off by.
So you think the commenting kind of culture can be too insular and a little
massively? I don't think anyone would really disagree at this point.
Right. The willingness to experiment here is very interesting to me. So you've done, like, broadly at sites. If you look at Defamer and Wonkette, Consumerist, they didn't necessarily work out that much. At least not as a business for you, right?
We've all lived on their own. Of 18 sites that we've launched, we've disposed of 9.
Right. But, I mean, like Fleshbot, right? Like, you have a porn site that didn't work as a business.
We've spun that off now.
Right. Yeah. So that's interesting, right? Is it didn't work as part of the core business?
No, it worked as a porn business. It just didn't work as a Gawker Media business.
Okay. So, and then, of course, the redesign was a very big experiment, right? Which is, even though you've recovered from that.
We're a private company.
So do you want to keep experimenting on that level? Do you think your comments experiment is going to be as radical an experiment as those?
You know, one of the things I think is a little bit sad on the web right now is that people don't experiment, and they don't experiment partly because they've had venture funding and they've got people have a board to watch out for, and you know, investors are actually often the most conventional thinkers around, and they want you to be consistent with whatever buzzword they've heard 3 months ago. I think Twitter and internet comments generally have also inhibited innovation. Mm-hmm. That what was the most absurd episode? The Gap logo. What was so bad about that Gap logo? Was it a crime? I mean, maybe it was ugly. Maybe some people didn't like it. But the idea that a major corporation, a successful major corporation, but I presume it actually had an idea for why it wanted to change its logo, that they could be bullied by a mob that represented probably 0.5% of their customer base, mm-hmm. is extraordinary. And I think that Twitter and internet comments, internet discussion, they've made people scared.
So the fact that Facebook keeps changing profiles in a way that pisses people off is probably a good thing by your recommendation.
Well, I think eventually if you're Steve Jobs, you're Mark Zuckerberg, you do enough without paying attention to criticism online that eventually... In the end, Steve Jobs wore down the Apple fanboys. Right. He eventually ground them down, and he had been so successful so many times over such a long period of time.
And they just assumed he was right,
People gave up on saying, you know, that Apple was somehow dumbing down the computing experience or whatever it was that they used to say.
How many of you had to switch directions on your trackpad or your mouse when Lion came out? I know there's a lot of Mac users here. Yeah, that's fucking crazy.
Here's the question.
Hey, so I work for Discuss, the commenting network, and actually we agree
I'm a big fan.
Thanks. We agree with a lot of what's been said so far. One thing, though, that I would maybe challenge you on, Nick, is something you'd said earlier, and it's kind of along the lines of Anil's post about, you know, your fault if your community's a bunch of assholes or whatever it was, which is we see a pretty strong, I mean, it's kind of anecdotal, but still a pretty strong correlation between when editors or authors are regularly involved in the discussions, and you know, sort of the long-term health of that community. And I think you said something.
You guys did some research on this recently, didn't you?
That research was slightly different. It was more about sort of identity choice, but that's also pretty interesting stuff. But this is slightly different. This is more about the actual author or editor or some sort of voice of authority being involved in the threads.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you said something like, you know, it's our writers don't have time to do it, which, you know, I understand there's a pace to it, but I guess my challenge is, you know, they do have time to, you know, tweet back at people and, you know, maintain their Facebook accounts and their Tumblrs, etc. Why neglect, you know, your own home turf, and why not build that into the workflow?
I think because, as we discussed, there is a feedback loop. And a nice site like Ionine or Lifehacker that ends up with a helpful community of people who actually add to the story, which maintains discipline, those are environments that people are actually happy to participate in. Every single writer on those sites participates in the stories. You know, when you get a more antagonistic relationship between writers and commenters, that feedback loop can work in the other way.
And what I'd say to that is we definitely see that too. But I think what can work well, and we've seen this not only work in sort of intimate communities, but even at scale. Like there's a bunch of writers at The Atlantic, and even at Time, you know, pretty large sites.
They're not large.
Fine.
But Ta-Nehisi Coates has an amazing community at the Atlantic.
One of the people I had in mind, exactly.
And they're talking about race, right?
It could be they're fairly talking about, polarized. This is politics. This is probably the most vitriolic, you know, category vertical out there. And I think what the point is, he sort of has preempted this nasty, vicious loop of, you know, commenters just hating and him hating
see,
back.
See what happens if they have five times the audience that they do right now. The Atlantic is a tiny, tiny site with a very niche audience.
So you think it's purely a matter of scale?
I think the problems occur when you develop scale. Yeah,
well, I think that's fair. I just think my point was that I think there's something to be said about even if, you know, I think there's something to be said about the writer, the editor, taking some ownership and having some thick skin and sort of being patient, because what we see is even if at first they get a lot of just nasty stuff back at them, it's kind of like, you know, if you see an empty alleyway, people are just going to, like, you know.
I've seen writers in tears. I've seen writers in tears.
Sure.
I've seen writers. Sometimes this works to our advantage, sometimes to our disadvantage. That you'll have a writer who'll, like Richard Lawson, he left for TV.com.
Right.
And the comments there were so unpleasant and stupid and homophobic that he came back because he wanted to be in a more positive environment.
No, I mean, I think some technology can help with some of that, but I guess all I was trying to say is what we see at its best is if, you know, a writer can sort of maintain a presence, ultimately often what happens is the community comes in and sort of, you know, starts to kind of, you know, take ownership themselves because they see that someone cares, you know, they see it's not just an abandoned.
And The Guardian has a similar policy too, that editors
But I think technology is also the solution. We need to deal with our writers. So we need to provide them with the technology tools that and the environment. We need to do as much as we can with the software to make the environment manageable. And then we can ask them, require them to spend more time in the comments. But the two go hand in hand. Mm-hmm. It's part of the solution.
Thanks. I typically hate it when people come to a mic and I just start pontificating, but that was very valuable.
Yeah,
thank
really
you.
Interesting.
Nick,
hey, Nick.
Question.
Hey, Nick Douglas.
Were you good at participating in comments?
Participate in the comments?
Yeah.
No.
I'm trying to remember. Nick used to work with us.
I think when Valleywig was around, there wasn't. I mean, one, scale issues were not a problem, and we really had a decent commenter base, and it was like a very regular set of people who were always, you know, putting forth the same viewpoint, and that is not interesting on a large scale, but at a small scale, you clearly need it. You know, there's a reason that you weren't searching for a complicated comment system back in that day. But I was wondering, a lot of the things you said that, like, well, when you get this large, you just can't do that anymore, are still done at, say, Reddit, where they have a different sort of, like, discussion that they're aiming for, but it seems to often be really fantastic and driven in a completely different way than what you're seeking. And so I'm wondering, like, because you've acknowledged that some of the sites are much more gossipy than others. Obviously, Lifehacker is trying to have a different kind of conversation than Gawker is trying to have. It seems like even you are aiming for a different sort of conversation. So have you been thinking about implementing different solutions across the different blogs, or are you really going to try to do something that works for all of them?
We're coming up with a system which works for all of them. So I think Lifehacker will benefit from it too. It's obviously not, we don't have such a problem at Lifehacker. Reddit's actually interesting because it's clearly, it's massive, it's fast growing, and some of the Ask Me Anything conversations, maybe not Woody Harrelson, but the, what was that, New York subway conductor? They had an Ask Me Anything with a New York subway conductor. Yeah, it was the most interesting thing I'd read that week. Yeah. It was amazing. It's also technically, it's the nested comments are extremely off-putting to most readers.
It's, yeah, the user experience is complicated, but if you look at an Ask Me Anything on Reddit, it's interesting that it's, you know, or at least was part of Condé Nast, because it's like a New Yorker profile and a Reddit Ask Me Anything have this sort of interesting symmetry to them, right?
but Reddit is not able to host competing political views. And within individual subreddits, there's incredible conformity in political opinion. Yeah. And anybody who comes in from the outside and tries to disagree is immediately shouted down or voted down.
Yeah, it can be a very sexist place. It's a very Ron Paul kind of place.
So Reddit, like a lot of these online environments, it's kind of contributing to a political kind of cultural environment, you know, of talk radio, of cable news.
So the filter bubble thing you think applies to Reddit,
yes,
as well?
Wouldn't it be cool if we could actually I'm not saying put Tea Party people and Occupy people in the same room and have them come up with a new constitution for America, but wouldn't it be nice if people who disagreed moderately about things could actually be in the same room and have a sensible conversation?
Hmm. What sites do that well right now?
What site does that well?
Yeah.
Only tiny sites.
Yeah.
I was just curious what your thoughts are on various social listening tools that are out there. And if they offer social listening tools, and if you guys get any value out of them in terms of deriving insights about what people are saying.
What kind of tools are you talking about?
You know, Radiant 6, Crimson Hexagon, stuff like that.
You guys, what do you use for analytics on social and traffic and things? You just have your own stats stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, nothing fancy.
Having
visited Gawker, I don't think that stuff is...
Tom Plunk, head of tech, is over there. Is there anything? No.
Yeah, it really seems like at Gawker, it's each editor kind of figures out what their tool set is between the tools that are publicly available, but they're all using consumer stuff. It's not some deeply integrated social media platform on the tech, right?
And you know, this gets back to my point about anonymity and first timers being important. That anyone who actually is registered as a regular commenter is probably going to be less interesting to us than somebody who has a document they want to leak or a photograph of some celebrity in flagrante.
Great outside contributors don't have a prior reputation on social media. So as we wrap up, this is a very interesting experiment. You're reckoning with one of the most kind of fundamental parts of your site. This is a big bet. One, this is something that's going to change on the site in, you said, 6 weeks or so, right? Very soon.
On Gawker.com, yeah.
Okay. And then presumably over the rest of the sites after that. What are the other big experiments coming forward? Are there new sites?
That's the biggest.
That's the biggest.
Yeah, this is much bigger than any other project we've been working on.
And you've taken risks before that haven't worked. Is this something, are you confident it's going to work?
What risks do we take that haven't worked?
You know, we have sites that didn't become valuable to the brand. Kinja didn't work, right? I love the site. It was good tech.
Well, actually,
but it wasn't as a property.
You know, there's like a ton of Kinja in the Gawker publishing platform.
I'm saying as a property, though. Right, didn't work. So you've had things that didn't work as part of the business as designed.
I think this is a relatively meaty project. There's one other part to it that we haven't talked about, which is that we want to create rights and responsibilities within comments ownership, separate threads, allow people to remove participants from those threads, to control the participation in those threads at every level of the thread. Mm. But we also want people to be able to talk not just to specific people, but about specific things. So the idea that there's a conversation about there's a 2,000-word post, and then there's a conversation about the post as a whole, is kind of ridiculous. The conversation should be about paragraph 6, or it should be about a specific part of an image or a particular frame of video. So there's a what I'm calling fractional commenting. That is
so like what SoundCloud does, where you can leave a comment on a particular part of a song.
What SoundCloud does with annotations, what Flickr does with annotations, but with threads being filtered, so you don't get an image cluttered with a thousand little bits of graffiti. But we use the same system we'll use in our mainstream comments in order to identify the most interesting things about that image or the most interesting things about a piece of video.
So it sounds like there's a lot of work left to do.
Yeah.
It's been a very interesting 10 years of watching. Hope you all join me in thanking Nick Denton for joining us today.